I crawled along the railroad embankment to the road and sat down to wait for Mom and Dad to come back. My whole body felt sore. The sun was small and white and broiling hot. A wind had come up and was roiling the dust along the roadside. I waited for what seemed like a long time before I decided it was possible Mom and Dad might not come back for me. They might not notice I was missing. They might decide it wasn't worth the drive back to retrieve me. That, like Coyote the cat, I was a bother and a burden they could do without. The little town behind me was quiet, and there were no other cars on the road. I started crying, but that only made me feel more sore. I got up and began to walk back toward the houses, and then I decided that if Mom and Dad did come for me, they wouldn't be able to find me, so I returned to the railroad tracks and sat down again. I was scraping the dried blood off my legs when I looked up and saw the green caboose come back around the bend. It was hurtling up the road toward me, getting bigger and bigger, until it screeched to a halt right in front of me. Dad got out of the car, knelt down, and tried to give me a hug. I pulled away from him. "I thought you were going to leave me behind," I said. "Aw, I'd never do that," he said. "Your brother was trying to tell us that you'd fallen out, but he was blubbering so damned hard, we couldn't understand a word he was saying." Dad started pulling the pebbles out of my face. Some were buried deep in my skin, so he reached into the glove compartment for a pair of needle-nose pliers. When he'd plucked all the pebbles from my cheeks and forehead, he took out his handkerchief and tried to stop my nose from bleeding. It was dripping like a broken faucet. "Damned, honey," he said. "You busted your snot locker pretty good." I started laughing really hard. Snot locker was the funniest name I'd ever heard for a nose. After Dad cleaned me up and I got back into the car, I told Brian and Lori and Mom about the word, and they all started laughing as hard as me. Snot locker. It was hilarious. We lived in Las Vegas for about a month in a motel room with dark red walls and two narrow beds. We three kids slept in one, Mom and Dad in the other. During the day, we went to the casinos, where Dad said he had a surefire system for beating the house. Brian and I played hide-and-seek among the clicking slot machines, checking the trays for overlooked quarters, while Dad was winning money at the blackjack table. I'd stare at the long-legged showgirls when they sashayed across the casino floor, with huge feathers on their heads and behinds, sequins sparkling on their bodies, and glitter around their eyes. When I tried to imitate their walk, Brian said I looked like an ostrich. At the end of the day, Dad came to get us, his pockets full of money. He bought us cowboy hats and fringed vests, and we ate chicken fried steaks in restaurants with ice-cold air conditioning and a miniature jukebox at each table. One night when Dad had made an especially big score, he said it was time to start living like the high rollers we had become. He took us to a restaurant with swinging doors like a saloon. Inside, the walls were decorated with real prospecting tools. A man with garters on his arms played a piano, and a woman with gloves that came up past her elbows kept hurrying over to light Dad's cigarettes. Dad told us we were having something special for dessert, a flaming ice cream cake. The waiter wheeled out a tray with a cake on it, and the woman with the gloves lit it with a taper. Everyone stopped eating to watch. The flames had a slow, watery movement, rolling up into the air like ribbons. Everyone started clapping, and Dad jumped up and raised the waiter's hand above his head as if he'd won first prize. A few days later, Mom and Dad went off to the blackjack table and then almost immediately came looking for us. Dad said one of the dealers had figured out that he had a system and had put the word out on him. He told us it was time to do the skedaddle. We had to get away from Las Vegas, Dad said, because the mafia, which owned the casinos, was after him. We headed west, through desert and then mountains. Mom said we should all live near the Pacific Ocean at least once in our lives, so we kept going all the way to San Francisco. Mom didn't want us staying in one of those tourist trap hotels near Fisherman's Wharf, which she said were inauthentic and cut off from the real life of the city. So we found one that had a lot more character in a place called the Tenderloin District. Sailors and women with lots of makeup stay there too. Dad called it a flop house, but Mom said it was an SRO. And when I asked what that stood for, she told me the hotel was for special residents only. While Mom and Dad went looking out for investment money for the prospector, we kids stayed in the hotel. One day, I found a half-full box of matches. I was thrilled, because I much preferred the wooden matches that came in boxes over the flimsy ones in the cardboard books. I took them upstairs and locked myself in the bathroom. I pulled off some toilet paper, lit it, and when it started burning, I threw it down the toilet. I was torturing the fire, giving it life and snuffing it out. Then I got a better idea. I made a pile of toilet paper in the toilet, lit it, and when it started burning, the flame shooting silently up out of the bowl, I flushed it down the toilet. One night, a few days later, I suddenly woke up. The air was hot and stifling. I smelled smoke and then saw flames leaping at the window. At first, I couldn't tell if the fire was inside or outside, but then I saw that one of the curtains, only a few feet from the bed, was ablaze. Mom and Dad were not in the room, and Lori and Brian were still asleep. I tried to scream to warn them, but nothing came out of my throat. I wanted to reach over and shake them awake, but I couldn't move. The fire was growing bigger, stronger, and angrier. Just then, the door burst open. Someone was calling our names. It was Dad. Lori and Brian woke up and ran to him, coughing from the smoke. I still couldn't move. I watched the fire, expecting that any moment my blanket would burst into flames. Dad wrapped the blanket around me and picked me up, then ran down the stairs, leading Lori and Brian with one arm and holding me in the other. Dad took us kids across the street to a bar, then went back to help fight the fire. A waitress with red fingernails and blue-black hair asked if we wanted a Coca-Cola, or heck, even a beer, because we'd been through a lot that night. Brian and Lori said yes, please, to Cokes. I asked if I might please have a Shirley Temple, which was what Dad bought me whenever he took me to a bar. For some reason, the waitress laughed. The people at the bar kept making jokes about women running naked out of the burning hotel. All I had on was my underwear, so I kept the blanket wrapped tightly around me. After I drank my Shirley Temple, I tried to go back across the street to watch the fire, but the waitress kept me at the bar, so I climbed up on a stool and watched through the window. The fire trucks had arrived. There were flashing lights and men in black rubber coats holding canvas hoses with big jets of water coming out of them. I wondered if the fire had been out to get me. I wondered if all fire was related, like Dad said all humans were related, if the fire that had burned me that day while I cooked hot dogs was somehow connected to the fire I'd flushed down the toilet and the fire burning at the hotel. I didn't have the answers to those questions, but what I did know was that I lived in a world that at any moment could erupt into fire. It was the sort of knowledge that kept you on your toes. After the hotel burned down, we lived for a few days on the beach. When we put down the back seat of the green caboose, there was room for everyone to sleep, though sometimes someone's feet would be sticking in my face. One night, a policeman tapped on our window and said we had to leave. It was illegal to sleep on the beach. He was nice and kept calling us folks, and even drew us a map to a place where we could sleep without getting arrested. But after he left, Dad called him the goddamn Gestapo and said that people like that got their jollies pushing people like us around. Dad was fed up with civilization. He and Mom decided we should move back to the desert and resume our hunt for gold without our starter money. "These cities'll kill you," he said. After we pulled up stakes in San Francisco, we headed for the Mojave Desert. Near the Eagle Mountains, Mom made Dad stop the car. She'd seen a tree on the side of the road that caught her fancy. It wasn't just any tree. It was an ancient Joshua tree. It stood in a crease of land where the desert ended and the mountain began, forming a wind tunnel. From the time the Joshua tree was a tiny sapling, it had been so beaten down by the whipping wind that, rather than trying to grow skyward, it had grown in the direction that the wind pushed it. It existed now in a permanent state of wind-blownness, leaning over so far that it seemed ready to topple. Although, in fact, its roots held it firmly in place. I thought the Joshua tree was ugly. It looked scraggly and freakish, permanently stuck in that twisted, tortured position. And it made me think of how some adults tell you not to make weird faces because your features could freeze. Mom, however, thought it was one of the most beautiful trees she had ever seen. She told us she had to paint it. While she was setting out her easel, Dad drove up the road to see what was ahead. He found a scattering of parched little houses, trailers settling into the sand, and shacks with rusty tin roofs. It was called Midland. One of the little houses had a for-rent sign. "What the hell," Dad said. "This place is as good as any other." The house we rented had been built by a mining company. It was white, with two rooms and a sway-back roof. There were no trees, and the desert sand ran right up to the back door. At night, you could hear coyotes howling. When we first got to Midland, those coyotes kept me awake. And as I lay in bed, I'd hear other sounds. Gila monsters rustling in the underbrush, moths knocking against the screens, and the creosote crackling in the wind. One night, when the lights were out and I could see a sliver of moon through the window, I heard a slithering noise on the floor. "I think there's something under our bed," I said to Lori. "It's merely a figment of your overly active imagination," Lori said. She talked like a grown-up when she was annoyed. I tried to be brave, but I had heard something. In the moonlight, I thought I saw it move. "Something's there," I whispered. "Go to sleep," Lori said. Holding my pillow over my head for protection, I ran into the living room where Dad was reading. "What's up, mountain goat?" he asked. He called me that because I never fell down while we were climbing mountains. "Sure-footed as a mountain goat," he'd always say. "Nothing probably," I said. "I just think maybe I saw something in the bedroom." Dad raised his eyebrows. "But it was probably just a figment of my overly active imagination." "Did you get a good look at it?" he asked. "Not really." "You must have seen it. Was it a big old hairy son of a bitch with the damnedest looking teeth and claws?" "That's it! And did it have pointed ears and evil eyes with fire in them? And did it stare at you all wicked-like?" he asked. "Yes, yes, you've seen it too." "Better believe I have. It's that old ornery bastard demon." Dad said he'd been chasing demon for years. By now, Dad said, that old demon had figured out that it had better not mess with Rex's walls. But if that sneaky son of a gun thought it was going to terrorize Rex Walls' little girl, it had, by God, got another think coming. "Go fetch my hunting knife," Dad said. I got Daddy's knife with a carved bone handle and the blade of blue German steel, and he gave me a pipe wrench, and we went looking for Demon. We looked under my bed where I had seen it, but it was gone. We looked all around the house, under the table, in the dark corners of the closet, in the toolbox, even outside in the trash cans. "Come here, you sorry-assed old demon," Dad called out in the desert night. "Come out and show your butt-ugly face, you yellow-bellied monster." "Yeah, come on, you mean old demon," I said, waving the pipe wrench in the air. "We're not scared of you." There was only the sound of the coyotes in the distance. This is just like that chicken shit demon, Dad said. He set me down on the front step and lit up a cigarette. Then he told me a story about the time Demon was terrorizing an entire town, and Dad fought it off in hand-to-hand combat, biting its ears and sticking his fingers in its eyes. Old Demon was terrified, because that was the first time it had met anyone who wasn't afraid of it. Damned old Demon didn't know what to think, Dad said, shaking his head with a chuckle. That was the thing to remember about all monsters, Dad said. They love to frighten people, but the minute you stare them down, they turn tail and run. All you have to do, Mountain Goat, is show old Demon that you are not afraid. Not much grew around Midland other than the Joshua tree, cacti, and the scrubby little creosote bushes that Dad said were some of the oldest plants on the planet. The great-granddaddy creosote bushes were thousands of years old. When it rained, they let off a disgusting, musty smell so animals wouldn't eat them. Only 4 inches of rain fell a year around Midland, about the same as in the northern Sahara, and water for humans came in on a train once a day in special containers. The only animals that could survive around Midland were lipless, scaly creatures such as Gila monsters and scorpions, and people like us. A month after we moved to Midland, Juju got bit by a rattlesnake and died. We buried him near the Joshua tree. It was practically the only time I ever saw Brian cry. But we had plenty of cats to keep us company. Too many, in fact. We had rescued lots of cats since we tossed Quixote out the window, and most of them had gone and had kittens. And it got to the point where we had to get rid of some of them. We didn't have many neighbors to give them to, so Dad put them in a burlap sack and drove to a pond made by a mining company to cool equipment. I watched him load the back of the car with bobbing, mewing bags. It doesn't seem right, I told Mom. We rescued them. Now we're going to kill them. We gave them a little extra time on the planet, Mom said. They should be grateful for that. Dad finally got a job in the gypsum mine, digging out the white rocks that were ground into the powder used in drywall and plaster of Paris. When he came home, he'd be covered with white gypsum powder, and sometimes we'd play ghost and he'd chase us. He also brought back sacks of gypsum, and Mom mixed it with water to make Venus de Milo sculptures from a rubber cast she ordered through the mail. It grieved Mom that the mine was destroying so much white rock. She said it was real marble and deserved a better fate, and that, by making her sculptures, she was at least immortalizing some of it. Mom was pregnant. Everyone hoped it would be a boy so Brian would have someone to play with other than me. When it got time for Mom to give birth, Dad's plan was for us to move to Blythe, 20 miles south, which was such a big town it had 2 movie theaters and 2 state prisons. In the meantime, Mom devoted herself to her art. She spent all day working on oil paintings, watercolors, charcoal drawings, pen and ink sketches, clay and wire sculptures, silk screens, and wood blocks. She didn't have any particular style. Some of her paintings were what she called primitive. Some were impressionistic and abstract. Some were realistic. I don't want to be pigeonholed, she liked to say. Mom was also a writer and was always typing away on novels, short stories, plays, poetry, fables, and children's books, which she illustrated herself. Mom's writing was very creative. So was her spelling. She needed a proofreader, and when Lori was just 7 years old, she would go over Mom's manuscripts, checking for errors. While we were in Midland, Mom painted dozens of variations and studies of the Joshua tree. We'd go with her and she'd give us art lessons. One time I saw a tiny Joshua tree sapling growing not too far from the old tree. I wanted to dig it up and replant it near our house. I told Mom that I would protect it from the wind and water it every day so it could grow nice and tall and straight. Mom frowned at me. You'd be destroying what makes it special, she said. It's the Joshua tree's struggle that gives it its beauty. I never believed in Santa Claus. None of us kids did. Mom and Dad refused to let us. They couldn't afford expensive presents, and they didn't want us to think that we weren't as good as other kids who, on Christmas morning, found all sorts of fancy toys under the tree that were supposedly left by Santa Claus. So they told us all about how other kids were deceived by their parents, how the toys the grown-ups claimed were made by little elves wearing bell caps in their workshop at the North Pole actually had labels on them saying, "Made in Japan." "Try not to look down on those other children," Mom said. "It's not their fault that they've been brainwashed into believing silly myths." We celebrated Christmas, but usually about a week after December 25th, when you could find perfectly good bows and wrapping paper that people had thrown away, and Christmas trees discarded on the roadside that still had most of their needles and even some silver tinsel hanging on them. Mom and Dad would give us a bag of marbles or a doll or a slingshot that had been marked way down in an after-Christmas sale. Dad lost his job at the gypsum mine after getting into an argument with a foreman, and when Christmas came that year, we had no money at all. On Christmas Eve, Dad took each of his kids out into the desert night one by one. I had a blanket wrapped around me, and when it was my turn, I offered to share it with Dad, but he said no thanks. The cold never bothered him. I was 5 that year, and I sat next to Dad, and we looked up at the sky. Dad loved to talk about the stars. He explained to us how they rotated through the night as the earth turned. He taught us to identify the constellations and how to navigate by the North Star. Those shining stars, he liked to point out, were one of the special treats for people like us who lived in the wilderness. Rich city folks, he'd say, lived in fancy apartments, but their air was so polluted they couldn't even see the stars. We'd have to be out of our minds to want to trade places with any of them. "Pick out your favorite star," Dad said that night. He told me I could have it for keeps. He said it was my Christmas present. "You can't give me a star," I said. "No one owns the stars." "That's right," Dad said. "No one else owns them. You just have to claim it before anyone else does. Like that Dago fellow, Columbus, claimed America for Queen Isabella. Claiming a star as your own has every bit as much logic to it." I thought about it and realized Dad was right. He was always figuring out things like that. "I could have any star I wanted," Dad said, "except Beetlejuice and Rigel, because Lori and Brian had already laid claim to them." I looked up at the stars and tried to figure out which was the best one. You could see hundreds, maybe thousands or even millions, twinkling in the clear desert sky. The longer you looked, and the more your eyes adjusted to the dark, the more stars you'd see, layer after layer of them gradually becoming visible. There was one in particular, in the west, above the mountains, but low in the sky, that shone more brightly than all the rest. "I want that one," I said. Dad grinned. "That's Venus," he said. "Venus was only a planet," he went on, "and pretty dinky compared to real stars. She looked bigger and brighter because she was much closer than the stars. Poor old Venus didn't even make her own light," Dad said. "She shone only from reflected light." He explained to me that planets glowed because reflected light was constant, and stars twinkled because their light pulsed. "I like it anyway," I said. I had admired Venus even before that Christmas. You could see it early in the evening, glowing on the western horizon. And if you got up early, you could still see it in the morning, after all the stars had disappeared. "What the hell," Dad said. "It's Christmas. You can have a planet if you want." And he gave me Venus. That evening over Christmas dinner, we all discussed outer space. Dad explained light years and black holes and quasars and told us about the special qualities of Betelgeuse, Rigel, and Venus. Betelgeuse was a red star in the shoulder of the constellation Orion. It was one of the largest stars you could see in the sky, hundreds of times bigger than the sun. It had burned brightly for millions of years and would soon become a supernova and burn out. I got upset that Lori had chosen a clunker of a star. But Dad explained that soon meant hundreds of thousands of years when you were talking about the stars. Rigel was a blue star, smaller than Betelgeuse, Dad said, but even brighter. It was also in Orion. It was his left foot, which seemed appropriate because Brian was an extra fast runner. Venus didn't have any moons or satellites or even a magnetic field, but it did have an atmosphere sort of similar to Earth, except it was super hot, about 500 degrees or more. So, Dad said, when the sun starts to burn out and Earth turns cold, everyone here might want to move to Venus to get warm. And they'll have to get permission from your descendants first. We laughed about all the kids who believed in the Santa Claus myth and got nothing for Christmas but a bunch of cheap plastic toys. Years from now, when all the junk they got is broken and long forgotten, Dad said, you'll still have your stars. At twilight, once the sun had slid behind the Palin Mountains, the bats came out and swirled through the sky above the shacks of Midland. The old lady who lived next door warned us away from the bats. She called them flying rats and said one got caught in her hair once and went crazy clawing at her scalp. But I love those ugly little bats, the way they darted past, their wings in a furious blur. Dad explained how they had sonar detectors kind of like the ones in nuclear submarines. Brian and I would throw pebbles hoping the bats would think they were bugs and eat them, and the weight of the pebbles would pull them down and we could keep them as pets, tying a long string to their claws so they could still fly around. I wanted to train one to hang upside down from my finger, but those darn bats were too clever to fall for our trick. The bats were out swooping and screeching when we left Midland for Blythe. Earlier that day, Mom had told us that the baby had decided it was big enough to come out soon and join the family. Once we were on the road, Dad and Mom got into a big fight over how many months she'd been pregnant. Mom said she was 10 months pregnant. Dad, who had fixed someone's transmission earlier that day and used the money to buy a bottle of tequila, said she'd probably lost track somewhere. I always carry my children longer than most women, Mom said. Lori was in my womb for 14 months. Bullshit, Dad said. Unless Lori's part elephant. Don't you make fun of me or my children, Mom yelled. Some babies are premature. Mine were all post-mature. That's why they're so smart. Their brains had longer to develop. Dad said something about freaks of nature, and Mom called him a Mr. Know-It-All smarty pants who refused to believe that she was special. Dad says something about Jesus H. Christ on a goddamn crutch not taking that much time to gestate. Mom got upset at Dad's blasphemy, reached her foot over to the driver's side, and stomped on the brake. It was the middle of the night, and Mom bolted out of the car and ran into the darkness. You crazy bitch, Dad hollered. Get your goddamn ass back in this car. You make me Mr. Tough Guy, she screamed as she ran away. Dad jerked the steering wheel to one side and drove off the road into the desert after her. Lori, Brian, and I braced one another with our arms, like we always did when Dad went on some wild chase that we knew would get bumpy. Dad stuck his head out the window as he drove, hollering at Mom, calling her a stupid whore and a stinking cunt, and ordering her to get back into the car. Mom refused. She was ahead of us, bobbing in and out of the desert brush. Since she never used curse words, she was calling Dad names like blankety-blank and worthless drunk so-and-so. Dad stopped the car, then jammed down the accelerator and popped the clutch. We shot forward toward Mom, who screamed and jumped out of the way. Dad turned around and went for her again. It was a moonless night, so we couldn't see Mom except when she ran into the beam of the headlights. She kept looking over her shoulder, her eyes wide like a hunted animal's. We kids cried and begged Dad to stop, but he ignored us. I was even more worried about the baby inside Mom's swollen belly than I was about her. The car bounced on holes and rocks, brush scratching against its side and dust coming through the open windows. Finally, Dad cornered Mom against some rocks. I was afraid he might smush her with a car, but instead he got out and dragged her back, legs flailing, and threw her into the car. We banged through the desert and onto the road. Everyone was quiet except Mom, who was sobbing that she really did carry Lori for 14 months. Mom and Dad made up the next day, and by late afternoon, Mom was cutting Dad's hair in the living room of the apartment we'd rented in Blythe. He'd taken off his shirt and was sitting backward on a chair with his head bowed and his hair combed forward. Mom was snipping away while Dad pointed to the parts that were still too long. When they were finished, Dad combed back his hair and announced that Mom had done a hell of a fine shearing job. Our apartment was in a one-story cinder block building on the outskirts of town. It had a big blue and white plastic sign in the shape of an oval and a boomerang that said, "The LBJ Apartments." I thought it stood for Lori, Brian, and Jeanette, but Mom said LBJ were the initials of the president, who, she added, was a crook and a warmonger. A few truck drivers and cowboys had rooms at the LBJ Apartments, but most of the other people who lived there were migrant workers and their families, and we heard them talking through the thin sheetrock walls. Mom said it was one of the bonuses of living at the LBJ Apartments, because we'd be able to pick up a little Spanish without even studying. Blythe was in California, but the Arizona border was within spitting distance. People who lived there liked to say the town was 150 miles west of Phoenix, 250 miles east of Los Angeles, and smack dab in the middle of nowhere. But they always said it like they were bragging. Mom and Dad weren't exactly crazy about Blythe. Too civilized, they said, and downright unnatural, too, since no town the size of Blythe had any business existing out in the Mojave Desert. It was near the Colorado River, founded back in the 19th century by some guy who figured he could get rich turning the desert into farmland. He dug a bunch of irrigation ditches that drained water out of the Colorado River to grow lettuce and grapes and broccoli right there in the middle of all that cactus and sagebrush. Dad got disgusted every time we drove past one of those farm fields with their irrigation ditches wide as moats. "It's a goddamn perversion of nature," he'd say. "If you want to live in the farmland, haul your sorry hide off to Pennsylvania. If you want to live in the desert, eat prickly pears, not iceberg pansy-ass lettuce." "That's right," Mom would say. "Prickly pears have more vitamins anyway." Living in a big city like Blythe meant I had to wear shoes. It also meant I had to go to school. School wasn't so bad. I was in the first grade, and my teacher, Miss Cook, always chose me to read aloud when the principal came into the classroom. The other students didn't like me very much because I was so tall and pale and skinny, and always raised my hand too fast and waved it frantically in the air whenever Miss Cook asked a question. A few days after I started school, four Mexican girls followed me home and jumped me in the alleyway near the LBJ Apartments. They beat me up pretty bad, pulling my hair and tearing my clothes and calling me a teacher's pet and a matchstick. I came home that night with scraped knees and elbows and a busted lip. "Looks to me like you got in a fight," Dad said. He was sitting at the table, taking apart an old alarm clock with Brian. "Just a little dust up," I said. That was the word Dad always used after he'd been in a fight. "How many were there?" "Six," I lied. "Is that split lip okay?" he asked. "This little old scratch?" I asked. "You should have seen what I did to them." "That's my girl," Dad said, and went back to the clock. But Brian kept looking over at me. The next day when I got to the alley, the Mexican girls were waiting for me. Before they could attack, Brian jumped out from behind a clump of sagebrush, waving a yucca branch. Brian was shorter than me and just as skinny, with freckles across his nose and sandy red hair that fell into his eyes. He wore my hand-me-down pants, which I had inherited from Lori and then passed on to him, and they were always sliding off his bony behind. "Just back off now, and everyone can walk away with their limbs still intact," Brian said. It was another one of Dad's lines. The Mexican girls stared at him before bursting into laughter. Then they surrounded him. Brian did fairly well fending them off until the yucca branch broke. Then he disappeared beneath a flurry of swinging fists and kicking feet. I grabbed the biggest rock I could find and hit one of the girls on the head with it. From the jolt in my arm, I thought I cracked her skull. She sank to her knees. One of her friends pushed me to the ground and kicked me in the face. Then they all ran off, the girl I hit holding her head as she staggered along. Brian and I sat up. His face was covered with sand. All I could see were his blue eyes peering out and a couple of spots of blood seeping through. I wanted to hug him, but that would have been too weird. Brian stood up and gestured for me to follow him. We climbed through a hole in a chain-link fence he'd discovered that morning and ran into an iceberg lettuce farm near the apartment building. I followed him through the rows of big green leaves, and we eventually settled down to feast, burying our faces in huge wet heads of lettuce and eating until our stomachs ached. "I guess we scared them off pretty good," I said to Brian. "I guess," he said. He never liked to brag, but I could tell he was proud that he had taken on four bigger, tougher kids, even if they were girls. "Lettuce war!" Brian shouted. He tossed a half-eaten head at me like a grenade. We ran along the rows, pulling up heads and throwing them at each other. A crop duster flew overhead. We waved as it made a pass above the field. A cloud sprayed out from behind the plane, and a fine white powder came sprinkling down on our heads. 2 months after we moved to Blythe, when Mom said she was 12 months pregnant, she at last gave birth. After she'd been in the hospital for 2 days, we all drove out to pick her up. Dad left his kids waiting in the car with the engine idling while he went in for Mom. They came running out with Dad's arm around Mom's shoulders. Mom was cradling a bundle in her arms and giggling sort of guiltily, like she'd stolen a candy bar from a dime store. I figured they had checked out Rex Wall's style. "What is it?" Lori asked as we sped away. "Girl," Mom said. Mom handed me the baby. I was going to turn 6 in a few months, and Mom said I was mature enough to hold her the entire way home. The baby was pink and wrinkly, but absolutely beautiful, with big blue eyes, soft wisps of blonde hair, and the tiniest fingernails I had ever seen. She moved in confused, jerky motions, as if she couldn't understand why Mom's belly wasn't still around her. I promised her I'd always take care of her. The baby went without a name for weeks. Mom said she wanted to study it first, the way she would the subject of a painting. We had a lot of arguments over what the name should be. I wanted to call her Rosita, after the prettiest girl in my class, but Mom said the name was too Mexican. "I thought we weren't supposed to be prejudiced," I said. "It's not being prejudiced," Mom said. "It's a matter of accuracy in labeling." She told us that both our grandmothers were angry because neither Lori nor I had been named after them, so she decided to call the baby Lily Ruth Maureen. Lily was Mom's mother's name, and Irma Ruth was Dad's mother's name. But we'd call the baby Maureen, a name Mom liked because it was diminutive of Mary, so she'd be naming the baby after herself, but pretty much no one would know it. That, Dad told us, would make everybody happy except his mom, who hated the name Ruth and wanted the baby called Irma, and Mom's mom, who would hate sharing her namesake with Dad's mom. A few months after Maureen was born, a squad car tried to pull us over because the brake lights on the green caboose weren't working. Dad took off. He said that if the cops stopped us, they'd find out that we had no registration or insurance, and that the license plate had been taken off another car, and they'd arrest us. After barreling down the highway, he made a screeching U-turn, with us kids feeling like the car was going to tumble over on its side. But the squad car made one, too. Dad peeled through Blythe at 100 miles an hour, ran a red light, cut the wrong way up a one-way street, the other cars honking and pulling over. He made a few more turns, then headed down an alleyway and found an empty garage to hide in. We heard the sound of a siren a couple of blocks away, and then it faded. Dad said that since the Gestapo would have their eyes out for the green caboose, we'd have to leave it in the garage and walk home. The next day, he announced that Blythe had become a little too hot and we were hitting the road again. This time, he knew where we were going. Dad had been doing some research and settled on a town in northern Nevada called Battle Mountain. There was gold in Battle Mountain, Dad said, and he intended to go after it with a prospector. Finally, we were going to strike it rich. Mom and Dad rented a great big U-Haul truck. Mom explained that since only she and Dad could fit in the front of the U-Haul, Lori, Brian, Maureen, and I were in for a treat. We got to ride in the back. It would be fun, she said, a real adventure. But there wouldn't be any light, so we would have to use all our resources to entertain one another. Plus, we were not allowed to talk. Since it was illegal to ride in the back, anyone who heard us might call the cops. Mom told us the trip would be about 14 hours if we took the highway. But we should tack on another couple of hours because we might make some scenic detours. We packed up what furniture we had. There wasn't much, mostly parts for the prospector and a couple of chairs and Mom's oil paintings and art supplies. When we were ready to leave, Mom wrapped Maureen in a lavender blanket and passed her to me, and we kids all climbed into the back of the U-Haul. Dad closed the doors. It was pitch black, and the air smelled stale and dusty. We were sitting on the ribbed wooden floor, on frayed, stained blankets, used to wrap furniture, feeling for one another with our hands. "Here goes the adventure," I whispered. "Shh," Lori said. The U-Haul started up and lurched forward. Maureen let loose with a loud, high-pitched wail. I shushed her and rocked her and patted her, but she kept crying. So I gave her to Lori, who whispered sing-song into her ear and told jokes. That didn't work either, so we begged Maureen to please stop crying. Then we just put our hands over our ears. After a while, it got cold and uncomfortable in the back of the dark U-Haul. The engine made the floor vibrate and would all go tumbling whenever we hit a bump. Several hours passed. By then, we were all dying to pee and wondering if Dad was going to pull over for a rest stop. Suddenly, with a bang, we hit a huge pothole, and the back doors on the U-Haul flew open. The wind shrieked through the compartment. We were afraid we were going to get sucked out, and we all shrank back against the prospector. The moon was out. We could see the glow from the U-Haul's taillights, and the road would come down, stretching back through the silvery desert. The unlocked doors swung back and forth with loud clangs. Since the furniture was stored between us and the cabin, we couldn't knock on the wall to get Mom and Dad's attention. We banged on the sides of the U-Haul and hollered as loud as we could, but the engine was too noisy and they didn't hear us. Brian crawled to the back of the van. When one of the doors swung in, he grabbed at it, but it flew open again, jerking him forward. I thought the door was going to drag Brian out, but he jumped back just in time and scrambled along the wooden floor toward Lori and me. Brian and Lori held tight to the prospector, which Dad had tied securely with ropes. I was holding Maureen, who for some strange reason had stopped crying. I wedged myself into a corner. It seemed like we'd have to ride it out. Then a pair of headlights appeared way in the distance behind us. We watched as the car slowly caught up with the U-Haul. After a few minutes, it pulled up right behind us, and its headlights caught us there in the back of the cab. The car started honking and flashing its brights. Then it pulled up and passed us. The driver must have signaled Mom and Dad, because the U-Haul slowed to a stop, and Dad came running back with a flashlight. "What the hell is going on?" he asked. He was furious. We tried to explain that it wasn't our fault the doors blew open, but he was still angry. I knew that he was scared, too, maybe even more scared than angry. Was that a cop? Brian asked. No, Dad said. And you're sure as hell lucky it wasn't, or he'd be hauling your asses off to jail. After we peed, we climbed back into the truck and watched as Dad closed the doors. The darkness enveloped us again. We could hear Dad locking the doors and double-checking them. The engine restarted, and we continued on our way. Battle Mountain had started out as a mining post, settled 100 years earlier by people hoping to strike it rich. But if anybody had ever struck it rich in Battle Mountain, they must have moved somewhere else to spend their fortune. Nothing about the town was grand except the big empty sky and, off in the distance, the stony purple Tuscarora Mountains running down to the Table Flat Desert. The main street was wide, with sun-bleached cars and pickups parked at an angle to the curb, but only a few blocks long, flanked on both sides with low, flat-roofed buildings made of adobe or brick. A single streetlight flashed red day and night. Along Main Street was a grocery store, a drugstore, a Ford dealership, a Greyhound bus station, and two big casinos, the Owl Club and the Nevada Hotel. The buildings, which seemed puny under the huge sky, had neon signs that didn't look like they were on during the day because the sun was so bright. We moved into a wooden building on the edge of town that had once been a railroad depot. It was 2 stories tall and painted an industrial green, and was so close to the railroad tracks that you could wave to the engineer from the front window. Our new home was one of the oldest buildings in town, Mom proudly told us, with a real frontier quality to it. Mom and Dad's bedroom was on the 2nd floor, where the station manager once had his office. We kids slept downstairs, in what had been the waiting room. The old restrooms were still there, but the toilet had been ripped out of one and a bathtub put in its place. The ticket booth had been converted into a kitchen. Some of the original benches were still bolted to the unpainted wood walls, and you could see the dark worn spots where prospectors and miners and their wives and children had sat waiting for the train, their behinds polishing the wood. Since we didn't have money for furniture, we improvised. A bunch of huge wooden spools, the kind that hold industrial cable, had been dumped on the side of the tracks not far from our house, so we rolled them home and turned them into tables. What kind of fools would go waste money on store-bought tables when they can have these for free, Dad said as he pounded the tops of the spools to show how sturdy they were. For chairs, we used some smaller spools and a few crates. Instead of beds, we kids each slept in a big cardboard box, like the ones refrigerators get delivered in. A little while after we'd moved into the depot, we heard Mom and Dad talking about buying us kids real beds, and we said they shouldn't do it. We liked our boxes. They made going to bed seem like a real adventure. Shortly after we moved into the depot, Mom decided that what we really needed was a piano. Dad found a cheap upright when a saloon in the next town over went out of business, and he borrowed a neighbor's pickup to bring it home. We slid it off the pickup down a ramp, but it was too heavy to carry. To get it into the depot, Dad devised a system of ropes and pulleys that he attached to the piano in the front yard and ran through the house and out the back door, where they were tied to the pickup. The plan was for Mom to ease the truck forward, pulling the piano into the house while Dad and we kids guided it up a ramp of planks and through the front door. Ready? Dad hollered when we were all in our positions. Okie doke, Mom shouted. But instead of easing forward, Mom, who had never quite gotten the hang of driving, hit the gas pedal hard, and the truck shot ahead. The piano jerked out of our hands, sending us lurching forward and bounced into the house, splintering the door frame. Dad screamed at Mom to slow down, but she kept going and dragged the screeching, cord-banging piano across the depot floor and right through the rear door, splintering its frame, too, then out into the backyard where it came to rest next to a thorny bush. Dad came running through the house. What the Sam Hill were you doing? He yelled at Mom. I told you to go slow. I was only doing 25, Mom said. You get mad at me when I go that slow on the highway. She looked behind her and saw the piano sitting in the backyard. Oopsie daisy, she said. Mom wanted to turn around and drag it back into the house from the other direction. But Dad said that was impossible because the railroad tracks were too close to the front door to get the pickup in position. So the piano stayed where it was. On the days Mom felt inspired, she took her sheet music and one of our spool chairs outside and pounded away at her music back there. Most pianists never get the chance to play in the great out-of-doors, she said. And now the whole neighborhood can enjoy the music, too. Dad got a job as an electrician in a barite mine. He left early and came home early, and in the afternoons we all played games. Dad taught us cards. He tried to show us how to be steely-eyed poker players, but I wasn't very good. Dad said you could read my face like a traffic light. Even though I wasn't much of a bluffer, I'd sometimes win a hand because I was always getting excited by even mediocre cards, like a pair of fives, which made Brian and Lori think I'd been dealt aces. Dad also invented games for us to play, like the Ergo game, in which he made two statements of fact, and we had to answer a question based on those statements, or else say, insufficient information to draw a conclusion, and explain why. When Dad wasn't there, we invented our own games. We didn't have many toys, but you didn't need toys in a place like Battle Mountain. We'd get a piece of cardboard and go tobogganing down the depot's narrow staircase. We'd jump off the roof of the depot, using an army surplus blanket as our parachute and letting our legs buckle under us when we hit the ground, like Dad had taught us real parachutists do. We'd put a piece of scrap metal, or a penny if we were feeling extravagant, on the railroad tracks right before the train came. After the train had roared by, the massive wheels churning, we'd run to get our newly flattened, hot and shiny piece of metal. The thing we liked to do most was go exploring in the desert. We'd get up at dawn, my favorite time when the shadows were long and purple, and you still had the whole day ahead of you. Sometimes Dad went with us, and we'd march through the sagebrush military style, with Dad calling out orders in a sing-song chant, hup, two, three, four. And then we'd stop and do push-ups, or Dad would hold out his arm so we could do pull-ups on it. Mostly Brian and I went exploring by ourselves. That desert was filled with all sorts of amazing treasures. We had moved to Battle Mountain because of the gold in the area, but the desert also had tons of other mineral deposits. There was silver and copper and uranium and barite, which Dad said oil drilling rigs used. Mom and Dad could tell what kind of minerals and ore were in the ground from the color of the rocks and soil. And they taught us what to look for. Iron was in the red rocks, copper in the green. There was so much turquoise, nuggets and even big chunks of it lying on the desert floor, that Brian and I could fill our pockets with it until the weight practically pulled our pants down. You could also find arrowheads and fossils, and old bottles that had turned deep purple from lying under the broiling sun for years. You could find the sun-parched skulls of coyotes and empty tortoise shells and the rattles and shed skins of rattlesnakes. And you could find great big bullfrogs that had stayed in the sun too long and were completely dried up and light as a piece of paper. On Sunday night, if Dad had money, we'd all go to the Owl Club for dinner. The Owl Club was world famous, according to the sign, where a hoot owl wearing a chef's hat pointed the way to the entrance. Off to one side was a room with rows of slot machines that were constantly clinking and ticking and flashing lights. Mom said the slot players were hypnotized. Dad said they were damn fools. Never play the slots, Dad told us. They're for suckers who rely on luck. Dad knew all about statistics, and he explained how the casinos stacked the odds against the slot players. When Dad gambled, he preferred poker and pool. Games of skill, not chance. Whoever coined the phrase, a man's got to play the hand that was dealt him, was most certainly one piss-poor bluffer, Dad said. The Owl Club had a bar where groups of men with sunburned necks huddled together over beers and cigarettes. They all knew Dad, and whenever he walked in, they insulted him in a loud, funny way that was meant to be friendly. "This joint must be going to hell in a handbasket if they're letting in sorry-ass characters like you," they'd shout. "Hell, my presence here has a positively elevating effect compared to you mangy coyotes," Dad would yell back. They'd all throw their heads back and laugh and slap one another between the shoulder blades. We always sat down at one of the red booths. "Such good manners," the waitress would exclaim, because Mom and Dad made us say sir and ma'am and yes please and thank you. "They're damned smart too," Dad would declare. "Finest damn kids ever walked the planet." And we'd smile and order hamburgers or chili dogs and milkshakes and big plates of onion rings that glistened with hot grease. The waitress brought the food to the table and poured the milkshakes from a sweating metal container into our glasses. There was always some left over, so she kept the container on the table for us to finish. "Looks like you hit the jackpot and got something extra," she'd say with a wink. We always left the Owl Club so stuffed we could hardly walk. "Let's waddle home, kids," Dad would say. The Barite mine where Dad worked had a commissary, and the mine owner deducted our bill and the rent for the depot out of Dad's paycheck every month. At the beginning of each week, we went to the commissary and brought home bags and bags of food. Mom said only people brainwashed by advertising bought prepared food such as SpaghettiOs and TV dinners. She bought the basics. Sacks of flour or cornmeal, powdered milk, onions, potatoes, 20-pound bags of rice or pinto beans, salt, sugar, yeast for making bread, cans of jack mackerel, a canned ham or a fat slab of bologna, and for dessert, cans of sliced peaches. Mom didn't like cooking much. "Why spend the afternoon making a meal that will be gone in an hour?" she'd ask us. "When in the same amount of time, I can do a painting that will last forever." So once a week or so, she'd fix a big cast iron vat of something like fish and rice or usually beans. We'd all sort through the beans together, picking out the rocks. Then Mom would soak them overnight, boil them the next day with an old ham bone to give them flavor, and for that entire week would have beans for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. If the beans started going bad, we'd just put a little extra spice in them, like the Mexicans at the LBJ apartments always did. We bought so much food that we never had much money come payday. One payday, Dad owed the mine company 11 cents. He thought it was funny and told him to put it on his tab. Dad almost never went out drinking at night like he used to. He stayed home with us. After dinner, the whole family stretched out on the benches in the floor of the depot and read, with a dictionary in the middle of the room, so we kids could look up words we didn't know. Sometimes I discussed the definitions with Dad, and if we didn't agree with what the dictionary writer said, we sat down and wrote a letter to the publishers. They'd write back defending their position, which would prompt an even longer letter from Dad. And if they replied again, so would he, until we stopped hearing from the dictionary people. Mom read everything. Charles Dickens, William Faulkner, Henry Miller, Pearl Buck. She even read James Michener apologetically, saying she knew it wasn't great literature, but she couldn't help herself. Dad preferred science and math books, biography and history. We kids read whatever Mom brought home from her weekly trips to the library. Brian read thick adventure books, ones written by guys like Zane Grey. Lori especially loved Freddie the Pig and all the Oz books. I liked Laura Ingalls Wilder stories and the We Were There series about kids who lived at great historical moments. But my very favorite was Black Beauty. Occasionally on those nights when we were all reading together, a train would thunder by, shaking the house and rattling the windows. The noise was thunderous, but after we'd been there a while, we didn't even hear it. Mom and Dad enrolled us at the Mary S. Black Elementary School. a long, low building with an asphalt playground that turned gooey in the hot sun. My second grade class was filled with the children of miners and gamblers, scabby-kneed and dusty from playing in the desert.